I'm Chris McAdoo, and this is Enjoyable Listen Time with Best Behavior, where we talk to people who make things and make things happen. And, with any luck, inspire you to do the same.
Yeah, we're recording.
Okay.
We're on. Right.
So, thanks to everybody for joining us today. This is Chris McAdoo, and I'm happy to have with me Bill May, the Executive Director of Aeromont, the Aeromont School of Arts and Crafts.
Correct.
Yes. Just speak a little bit closer into the mic.
How's that?
There we go.
Is it going to work?
Yeah, these are SM58s. You got to kind of talk close to them, but you can also use them as a hammer if needed.
Okay.
That's good. So today we're going to talk to Bill about kind of what brought him to where he is today with Aeromont as a glass artist, sort of his, you know, your own career, right? As well as sort of shepherding the careers of so many people and seeing so many people come through this school. And then, of course, we're going to talk about Aeromont, what's going on, and the literal and figurative sort of Phoenix style rising from the ashes over the past few years.
All right. Sounds good.
So, Bill, tell me a little bit about, where'd you come from? Where'd you start out?
I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. Grew up in the 50s and 60s during the height of the civil rights movement, and that had a profound effect on me in very many ways. I left Birmingham to go off to my undergraduate studies, which were at Tulane University, and lived in a few different places, lived in Washington for a little bit. I'm a person who never knew... I was never career-driven. I was always driven by curiosity, but not by this, having a particular job. I was always interested in a wide variety of things. My undergraduate degrees were in English and psychology, no art. I've always pursued things and opportunities because I found them interesting and I found them an opportunity to grow, not as a career path. And that's remained, of all the different things that I've done and all the twists and turns and doors that that I've opened and doors that I've closed and doors that were slammed in my face, it's always just been looking for every day's a new possibility to learn something. I think that's part of what being an artist is. And so it's worked out pretty well for me.
Well, here you are in Gatlinburg. What brought you to Gatlinburg, Sevierville, the South? Are you back to East Tennessee or in East Tennessee?
Well, I had been in graduate school at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. I'd been studying English literature. I thought I wanted to be a Blake scholar. And I got married, and when I got married, I decided I needed to get a job. I needed to make some money, and I got a teaching certificate, and I actually taught. I was a high school English teacher. And realized pretty quickly that I didn't think that was going to be something I'd want to do for the rest of my life. Again, not being a very sometimes I think I'm not a very ambitious person, but I certainly am not a career-oriented person. I started thinking about not where I wanted to work, but where I wanted to live. And I had come up to the Smoky Mountains as a child. I was in the Boy Scouts. We used to hike and camp up here. And I had this crazy, of course, you got to remember, this was in the late 70s, early 80s. I had this thing about wanting to live off the land, wanting to farm, wanting to have a garden, wanting to grow my own food, wanting to raise animals. And crazily enough, I wanted to build my own house. And I bought a 17 or 18 foot, I can't remember now, Airstream travel trailer. Had a convertible Volkswagen that wouldn't even pull it. But the guy I bought it from agreed to pull it up here from Alabama. We put it in a campground. We started looking for property. I bought 16 acres and began to pull the Airstream up on the property. Lived in it for 7 years while I built my house.
And how old were you at this point?
Oh, let's see. Old enough I should have known better. No, everything was an adventure then, I guess. So I was... It would have been 1981, so I was about About 27.
Okay. So you have made the move to is it Sevier County?
I actually live, yeah, Sevier County, and okay. I actually live between Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg, sort of on
gotcha.
on a country road, and, you know, have a very picturesque sort of farm, gentleman's farm that I live on.
So you're married, you're in an Airstream, you're building your house. How much did you know about building a house?
I grew up in a household that my father didn't even own a hammer. So, interestingly enough, I've always taken on things that I got interested in, and I haven't thought about, you know, I don't know anything about this. It was kind of the fact that I didn't know anything about things that inspire me and energize me. So, you know, I got some books. I was interested in building a eco-friendly house, so I ended up designing myself on a legal pad, a little passive solar cottage, and I had some of the work contracted out. I had somebody do the block work. I had somebody double-check my electrical work, and other than that, I had a few friends that helped me, a few woodworkers that came over and helped me with some framing and sheetrocking and things like that, so it became sort of a collaborative project in some ways. Couldn't have done it without them. But the long and the short of it is I paid for the house as I went, and that's why it took almost 7 years. And if you ask my wife, she'll tell you it's still not finished, and I'm sure.
One day.
I'm sure it's not, but it's livable anyway. So we've been there. We've been there. You know, my wife Ann and I have lived in that house now. We've been married for 25 years since we moved here.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you raised, how many kids do you have?
I have two.
Okay.
I have a son and a daughter. My son is a sophomore at Maryville College, and my daughter recently graduated from Georgetown and works in D.C.
Awesome. Awesome. So you have been in this community seeing it grow.
36 years.
Yeah. Wow. Well, what are, I mean, I guess, so you started out as a you know, English psychology. You're studying English. You were going to become a high school English teacher.
Correct.
A lot of folks, you know, you may or may not know Bill as a glass artist.
Right.
Right. Tell me, what was the impetus behind sort of, where did you find that? Like, what brought you there?
Well, as I say, I tend to get interested in things. And when I was building the house, I got interested in glass. I was interested in, you know, solar design. And I got interested in stained glass. I got interested in decorative glass. And I met a guy that was starting a stained glass studio. He asked me if I wanted to work with him. I basically became an apprentice in that studio. During that period of time, the academic part of me kind of resurfaced. And I said, you know, I really don't have a fundamental background in design and some of the things. And I knew if I was going to stick with it, I would need that, or I wanted that. And somebody said, well, there's this place called Aramont School of Arts and Crafts, and it's only about 6 miles from here, and they teach all kinds of things. And the cliche is, in my case, is 100% true. It changed my life. I came here. I started taking classes. I'd take my vacation, and I'd take a class. I'd come up here in the evenings to the free lectures and sit in the back with my notebook and make doodles and drawings and diagrams and write down what inspired me. I took some stained glass classes. I took some sculpture classes. I took some drawing classes and sort of self-educated myself all the time, working practically with my hands in the studio. Flash forward about 7 years, and I guess 8 years, and I decided to go out on my own. I took a barn on my property, moved the hogs out, put in a concrete floor, and started building the studio, sort of one room at a time, and learned. Had some very good opportunities. We just did architectural commission work. Had a couple of great people that worked with me, and we built the business up. You know, we ended up doing work in about 7 states, and a lot of projects that I'm very, very proud of. And ironically, to cut to the chase, I mean, what happened is that they called me from Aramont after I'd been a student for 6 or 7 years, and now I had this business and this portfolio, and they said, hey, you want to come back and teach? So I got my second view of Aramont as an instructor. Did that for 6 or 7 years, and as I was a practicing artist, and came back, and, you know, that's how I got back in. That's how I learned about glass. That's how I got interested in glass. And like most things in my life, I once I'm interested in something, I'm pretty tenacious about figuring out how to do it.
Yeah. Driven by curiosity.
Yep.
There it is again. Well, so what are some of the things, I guess, so we've gone through, we know where you're from, and it is kind of funny and ironic that coming from a home whose dad didn't own a hammer.
Right.
To like heading up one of the most respected arts and crafts schools in the nation, if not the world.
I'd like to think so. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, flash forward a little bit. You've seen this community grow, you know, Gatlinburg, Sevier County, from a tourism angle, right?
Right?
And I want to talk a little bit about what you have seen, Aramont specific. What are some of the stories that you have coming out of here? Who are some of the people that you have met that I think people would be surprised come to, you know, Gatlinburg, Tennessee, in the middle of the Southeast? I know that down in the bookstore when I first got here, I took a kind of a tour of the place, and there was a lady from Japan. Yes. Who was taking, I forget which class that she was taking.
She's taking the metalworking class.
Metalworking, yeah. Class, who in Japan is a master jeweler.
Correct.
Right? That's fascinating, the people you sort of run into. So who are some of the folks that stand out to you as, you know, maybe just neat people to meet or sort of, you know?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people want you to start naming off famous artists. I think the more interesting thing is the variety of people and what their motivation is, why they come here. We have people that come here that are 17 years old, 18 years old, that are, you know, students. And I think a couple of years ago, we had a 93-year-old woodturner from Texas. So variety of ages, variety of backgrounds, variety of skill levels. And what they end up getting out of the experience of coming here varies so widely that it's really hard to describe. Obviously, we have about 150 instructors that come through every year. They are some of the best in their particular medium.
Sure.
And they're always interesting. But just as interesting are the people who come as students. And I think I mentioned to you when we were having lunch, I mean, I might be sitting in the dining hall and one side is an 18-year-old who's working on their BFA, just getting started, kind of like where I was, you know, a long time ago. And on the other side of me may be somebody who's actually a student but is a professor, full professor somewhere, has work in the Renwick Museum, you know, and extremely accomplished. And those people are working side by side, maybe 117, maybe 165. Mm-hmm. But they're here doing the same thing. They're here for the same purpose. They're here to be creative, to take some chances, to learn something, you know, about a material or about themselves. And in the course of that, they learn something about each other.
Sure.
And that's the most exciting thing, is seeing people come here, share, open up, feel safe to be creative, feel safe to exchange and respect each other regardless of what their background is, what their ability level is. That's what's exciting. And then I just start talking. Sure, had a couple here that, you know, that had their honeymoon here. You know, they came to Gatlinburg in the 50s to have their honeymoon. And there wasn't any place to stay, and they ended up staying here on campus. And they came back year after year after year after that. So I think that's the key, is the types of people. You see everything from you walk through a studio and you see somebody that hitchhiked in who is just getting started, and you talk to somebody who's a retired surgeon.
Okay.
So
people from all varieties, all backgrounds, people from all over the world.
All over the world.
And talk to me a little bit about that purpose. Because one of the things that I always, I harp on it, you know, and I try to keep up with it myself, but when it comes to the arts, art making or craft making or whatever you want to call it, the making of the things, and you just, you know, you said both, again, literally and figuratively, it changed your life. It changed the trajectory of your life.
Right.
What are some of the sort of transformative experiences that you have kind of seen people go through in terms of their craft or, you know, I guess just sort of opening yourself up to those ideas?
Well, I think that what happens is I personally believe that people are born curious. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when people say, I don't know how to draw, and I always remind somebody, you put a 4-year-old in a room with a blank wall and a box of crayons and see if they don't know how to draw.
Yeah.
So I think people are inherently curious, and I think they're inherently creative. How that manifests itself, what motivates them, what they get into as far as a material, an object. I think that's as varied as people are. I personally just am interested that people have a safe, respectful place to come and experiment in a non-judgmental, that's not to say a non-guided. You know, my philosophy about Aramont is people come, they need to feel safe, they need to feel welcomed, and they need to feel encouraged, but they don't need to be patronized. You know, coming and spending a week at Aramont is not the same as, well, I'll go to Aramont and take a workshop and learn something, or I'll go on a cruise. Two different things.
This is not a spa vacation.
Exactly. Exactly. This is an intensive, immersive learning experience, but it's one that's done collaboratively. It's one where you're with a group of people, even though you may vary widely in your, their characteristics of who you are, you're engaged in a common pursuit, and that is to explore material, to work with an instructor, to learn a new technique. And as I always like to say, if they have a really good week, they learn something about each other, and hopefully they learn something about themselves.
Sure. Well, let's sort of go.
I don't know if I answered your question, Chris.
I think so. Oh, yeah.
I danced around it anyway.
Well, I mean, I just know, you know, for me, being able to make things is always my, that's always my foundation.
Right. Centers you and
yeah,
whatnot.
That's the thing, you know, above all else that reminds me that I can make something that someone else may make. I can make something that is totally
uniquely
mine.
Yours.
Exactly.
Yes. Reflect your vision and your abilities.
And that, I think, is such a powerful thing. And to see someone that maybe didn't or doesn't have that confidence gain that confidence, I think that's life altering.
That's what's exciting, and you've hit upon the thing that I think is the most exciting thing for me, and that is to see someone come, learn something about a material, learn something about themselves, learn something about a technique, and become confident that they can be a maker, that they can be a shaper, because it's not just a shaper of an object. It's sort of taking responsibility for yourself as a creative person, and once you do that, once you have the confidence that, hey, I can manipulate things, I'm in control, maybe in just in control of a block of wood or a slab of clay or a canvas, but you say, you know, I can express myself and I can make something. One of the things that happens that's very exciting to me, I guess philosophically, sociologically, is I don't think you're ever again a completely mindless consumer. You're a creator.
Dude, that's, yeah. That's the thing.
And that's exciting. For that happens to anybody, regardless of where they are in their life, regardless of where they are in their skill level, that can still happen. That transition from, you know, I'm a creator.
I make things.
Right.
And that may be a thing that is, again, totally unique to your place in life.
Right.
Your skill set, some people want to sculpt, some people want to draw, some people want to make music. But I think that confidence, that ability to know that you can make things, leads and bleeds into other parts of your life. Right as we were kind of getting ready, there's a book on Bill's desk called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters by Peter Korn, who I'm unfamiliar with, but furniture maker.
Yes.
But check out the book. But there's on a page that it's design and decision making. I just came across a sentence that I thought was pretty cool. And he says, I often meet people who think that the ability to design is beyond their reach, a mystical gift bestowed on others. And that is how so many people think about the creative process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody else can do that, but it's not for me.
Well, I think it's an excuse we used in a lot of ways, that somehow there are talented people, there are gifted people, and certainly there are talented and gifted people. I'm not, you know, there are people that are 6'8", and there are people that are 5'4", and the 5'4" people make better jockeys, and the 6'8" people make
better basketball players.
That's not what we're talking about. But the idea, if you give up the idea that you, I almost think you have a responsibility to create, to develop ideas, to develop, you know, your sense of yourself, because I think then you develop the ability to be a contributor in whatever you do, the rest other parts of your life. You just become a person who doesn't think something happens to you, but thinks, I have the ability to shape an object. Therefore, I have the opportunity and the confidence to shape ideas. And finally, you feel like you can shape your own life. And if you can shape your own life, you can shape the culture.
Sure.
That sounds pretty. That's pretty heavy for this early in the afternoon.
But, we're there, going into the weekend. After this, we can just shut it off.
Okay.
But no, I love that. So we are getting into a great piece of territory, though. The responsibility to create.
Yeah,
like I love that.
Yeah,
because you have. I think you know. You're saying that you know. We are all born maybe with innate talents towards
right.
something.
Well, curiosity. If you didn't, and if you just curious. Say curiosity, people, everybody's born curious, and
right.
we learn to not be that. We learn to be consumers. We don't learn. We forget that every morning there's no reason not to look at it as a blank canvas and to be curious about what you can make, what you can do, and sometimes it's making your own life. It's not just making an object.
Yeah. Well, that I'm gonna like the contributing, the change, the mind, the shift of the mind from full time consumer,
yes,
to contributor,
yes,
I think is just absolutely huge, and that contribution can be made. Again, we're talking about making objects here or making things, mm-hmm. but it can also be just confidence building in others. You want to go be a basketball coach? Go be one.
Right. Right.
Do you want to, you know, like things that you have a responsibility to do because you have a certain station in life or, you know, or whatever, like go and pursue those interests,
mm-hmm.
even though they may fly in the face of what you're quote unquote supposed to be doing.
Right. Well, that's certainly the way my life has gone. I mean, I think that when we talk about being a creator or an artist, being a craftsperson, you know, I think there's skill, certainly there's training, certainly there's dedication, but attitude and stance has a lot to do with
sure.
with whether you can be successful or not. And if you feel creative, if you feel, again, it's an empowering thing, whether it's a, you know, I've seen, we bring students here, and I'll give you an example. I mean, we had an eighth grade girl here who, you know, her teacher told me not a particularly good student, didn't fit in well, didn't have very high self-esteem, and I know that self-esteem is a loaded expression these days. But she took a basket-making class, and all of a sudden, she made the most incredible basket that anybody in her class had ever seen. And to be honest, it was as good as anything I'd ever seen, certainly out of somebody who wasn't, you know, a trained artist. Yeah. And she came up to me afterwards, and she said, I'm really glad I got the chance to be here. This was pulling herself away from all of her friends who were gathered around her, telling her how amazing she was. This was a girl that didn't get that kind of attention. She said, this has been the best school day I've ever had.
Wow.
Her teacher called me a little bit later, a few months later, and she said, that self-esteem, that confidence spilled over into the way she approached the rest of her studies. And so
wow.
when you hear that happen, when you know that can happen and you see it happen, I mean, you know, the cliche around here, we always laugh about it, but that is the staff and the instructors. We always kid each other about it because every week someone comes up to you and says, I just wanted to tell you that this week has been the best week of my life, or this week has changed my life. It's changed the way I look at things. It's changed the way I feel about myself. It's changed my confidence level. I'm going to take this back to my studio. And you hear that all the time, and it makes you want to keep going.
You want to keep, man, that is, that's, I'm sure there are incredible stories like that that happen, like you said, like every
weekly.
Week, every day.
Sure.
Well, let's get, we'll sort of back out a little
yeah,
bit.
Okay.
And we'll just, let's talk Aramont for a second, yep. Because you've been the director since.
Well, I've been here for 7 years. I'm just starting my seventh year as the director.
And in that time, Aramont has, again, you know, sort of risen from the ashes in two times.
Correct.
Once in 2013-2014, when the original, the owner of the property was going to sell. Or
our founding philanthropist, yeah. The Pi Beta Phi Fraternity for Women, changed their philanthropy. Their vision and generosity started this place. And if they hadn't come here in 1912, yep. Over 100 years ago, and brought basic education and economic development, medical care, if they hadn't come to this area, none of this would exist. But when it flash forward between 2008 and 2012, they made the decision to change their philanthropy, and you know, this property and this school was an asset, and it's one that they wanted to convert and use that money for other things. And so, as alarming as that was to us, it forced us to have the opportunity to reassess, and it was a challenge, but it gave us the opportunity to reassess, and you know. Decide, you know, the Aramont board, we should be independent. We should own this property. We should be here for the long haul. You know, we shouldn't be renters. We shouldn't lease this property.
Sure.
And fortunately, some very thoughtful, very generous people with vision from this community and throughout the country worked together to raise the $8 million that it took to buy the property.
And how quickly did you raise that money?
You know, I hear different stories. People remind me, and I'll be honest, I was putting one foot in front of the other, just trying to look for the next source of income for us. But it was about between 7 and 8 months.
Okay, so that in itself is incredible. And what it is a you know, in my mind, a situation that could have very easily become a woe is me, well, it's time has come and passed, you know, kind of a thing.
Yes.
But I think it's a testament to the power of, or the staying power of an organization like this, but of the arts in general to have, I mean, you know, you have individuals from all over the world. You have the city of Gatlinburg. You right. have all of these things that had to come together to say, you know what, this is important.
Right.
This particular place where people go and they make and they create and they learn how to contribute. They learn how to shape lives.
Right.
They learn how to shape things. You know, this is an important part of our culture, and we're going to do what it takes.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. I think the other point is, you know, I have people say, well, if you could raise $8 million, you know, come work for us, and that sounds great. And, you know, I always tell people, and they have to remember this, yes, I'm passionate about the school. Yes, I understand all the various ways that this place, this institution, organization can affect people, because it has affected me. But remember, you know, Chris, that this had an over 100-year history. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like when you say we raised the money in this incredibly short period of time. But really, the goodwill, the value that was placed upon this institution, it had accumulated almost like a bank account over 100 years.
Yeah.
That's the way I think of it. And then when it was time to do the right thing, it was time to make sure to come forward and say, yes, this is important. This is important to this community. It's important to the culture. It's important to education. So we're going to step up. But it's almost like we went to the bank and took a withdrawal from a savings account
of 100 years
that had accumulated yeah. over 100 years of doing good things for a lot of people. Does that make sense?
It does. Well, it does. And what you are doing is kind of getting getting back to that, satisfying that curiosity.
Right.
That people have. If you believe that people are innately curious and you give an outlet for a century mm-hmm. for people to explore that curiosity,
right.
for people to become confident.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, sure, you are going to fill that bank account.
Yeah.
Because you're doing things, like you say, that matter to people.
Right. Well, it's not, I think that you build up, you are what you are because of what you do every day. My expression is this, I mean, the values that you try to live out every day, that's what you fall back on. I always say, prepare for the extraordinary during the ordinary. In other words, whether it's having to raise the money to buy the property, whether it's having to deal with the fire and recover from that, you need to be able to fall back on the values and the mission and the beliefs that you have, that you are trying to work on and that you are living out every day. That's where you're, I think of it like an athlete. You don't decide suddenly that you're going to go out and be a lifeguard and save somebody drowning. You don't decide you're going to run a marathon. You train.
Yeah.
It's who you are. It's what your habits are. It's what your values are. And fortunately, this institution, this organization, with its great history, when we looked at who cared about it, because I had to sit down and think, well, who cares about this? Who does this matter to? Well, we had the cultural history, the literal history of people whose grandparents had gone to school here, whose probably were alive because their grandparents were vaccinated in the medical clinic.
Wow.
Think about that sort of thing. Who understood that the financial development of this town had a lot to do with this settlement school being here. But we have six buildings on the National Register of Historic Places. Mm-hmm. So who cares about this place? Preservationists, educators, artists, community leaders, and then, yes, even environmentalists, because they did not want to see this campus become another development.
Sure.
They wanted this to keep the green space, to keep the... So you think about all the ways that people should care and have a be willing to make an investment in something. And you just kind of point that out and remind them of that, remind them how it is a reflection of their values and what they care about, and then you ask them for money. You ask them to keep, to invest in something they think is important.
Sure. Well, and it's a whole lot easier to talk about something with a strong foundation.
Yeah.
Because it's not, in like, I guess, a software term, this is not vaporware. This is real stuff.
Right.
And this has made differences. And like we said, it's made differences in people's lives for, a century.
Yes.
Man. Well, so you get through that. That was what, 2013, 2014?
We closed on the property. We closed on the property officially the day after April's Fool Day in 2014.
You don't want to close on April Fool's.
So, yeah, that was a big milestone for us. And, again, it was a reflection of the confidence and the value that a lot of people have in the organization. Yeah.
That's great. Well, okay, so, fast forward, fast forward a few years, and a lot of the folks that are listening, they probably saw you on Facebook or CNN or something during last year's wildfires that hit, that hit Gatlinburg, and I know you can't talk about all of it, but I know that you are probably the most firsthand set of eyes. They were the first firsthand set of eyes that a lot of people had on what was going on. And I guess, from what you can you walk me through a little bit about sort of what happened and sort of how you guys dealt with it?
I can try. It's still difficult in a way for me to talk about for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think now I talk about it and I can talk about Aramont and what it meant to us. I can't begin to describe, the effect on the community. I know dozens of people who lost their homes. Obviously, we had a lot of deaths from it was a tragedy. And I don't pretend to be an authority on anything other than I know what I experienced here. the fires, we were aware late in the afternoon, early evening on the 28th of November that the campus was threatened, and we evacuated. We have five artists in residence. I told them that they needed to go ahead and grab what they could and leave. My wife was here working, and another one of our employees who lives on campus, and I told her, I said, you know, Heather, you need to get your dog. And by that time, the spur had closed. We learned that there was no way to exit down the spur, which is normally the way you would leave town, but it was completely closed and on fire. So my wife was able to lead the artist in residence and our employee Heather off campus safely, going through the back way and getting out. I stayed, not because I'm a hero. I just stayed because I didn't know what else to do, and I felt like I wanted to try to do something. You know, school means a lot to me, and again, I didn't have any. And, you know, it wasn't like I could stop the fire. I mean, I hosed down a few things. I put some water here and there. I ran around frantically trying to decide what I could save. Should I move? You know, I've told people, you go in the gallery and you pick up objects, and you think you go in the closet where the rooms where we keep the permanent collection, and you grab a piece. No, not this piece, this piece, this. No, no, this piece. And you finally realize that you can't save. You know, you're not, if it's going to come, it's, you can't save anything. Yeah. So, you know, and fortunately, you know, unfortunately, I realized that the campus was on fire at that point. Mm-hmm. I saw the glow up in the hollow where you and I walked a few minutes ago, and went up there and saw that two of our dormitories were engulfed, and our maintenance building was already pretty much burned to the ground, and it was threatening the Red Barn and threatening to spread throughout the campus. I found a fire crew. I got in the car, went off campus, found a fire crew. They came back onto the campus. I think they began to wet down the Red Barn, protect it, to tamp down some other areas, try to damp down the fire. As I said to you, I can't tell you what the combination is. I'm certainly glad that they came. I think they had, you know, a major effect. I also think that about that time, the weather changed, the wind died down, and the rain came in earnest, and I think that helped. But when I actually left, it was a mandatory evacuation, and they told me I had to leave. And as I mentioned, my wife had called to tell me that our house was under mandatory evacuation, and I needed to get home and get our pets out and, you know, get our neighbor out and see what I could do at home. So I left, and when I left, it was about 10:30, 10:45, I guess, and I didn't, you know, as I told you, I mean, I left not knowing, hoping, I was hopeful, but not being able to know whether the campus and the school were would survive.
And this was, you're saying, this is about 10:45, 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
And, you know, watching at home and seeing all of this happen, there's a lot of people that were tuned in, and it both looked like, and in reality, so much was, the mountains were on fire.
Yeah, it was pretty extensive. It ended up being, I think, 17,000 acres. So
yeah,
it was pretty extensive, and 2,400 structures, you know, destroyed, damaged, and destroyed. So yeah, it was horrific.
So I know that, you know, you were the first on the scene in the morning. Tell me a little bit about when you were able to get to the school. Tell me about what it was like sort of coming back up and seeing those buildings still standing.
Well, that's hard.
That's
hard to talk about. I mean, it's very, and I don't tend to be a very emotional person, but, you know, when I came in, it was still dark. The smoke was still incredibly thick. There were still fires burning, obviously, around the area. And when my headlights came around the drive, and I simply began to catalog, take an inventory of buildings as I saw them. You know, the Clay Studio still stands.
Yeah, yeah.
Turner Building still stands. The Wood Studio still stands. And I just almost had a mantra, you know. I was just going through as my headlights would hit the various buildings, and I could see through the smoke and the dark. And then when I got to the Red Barn, having left thinking that it probably was not going to survive, and it being a really iconic building. Mm-hmm. When I rounded the curve in the Kennedy campus and my lights hit the red barn, I lost it then, you know.
Yeah.
I was you know, weeping and crying, and you know, just tears of joy and unbelievable that it everything had survived. And the buildings that I had seen destroyed were, in fact, the only buildings that were destroyed by the fire. So a mixed blessing, you know, sad that we'd lost things, but feeling incredibly fortunate, especially when I began to understand, you know, the depth of the destruction
all
in the community.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and so that was during a very tumultuous time. I mean, and then, you know, Gallenberg was closed down for quite some time.
Yes.
Can you tell me sort of what happened next? Because it, admittedly, we took a tour of the campus where the dorms stood, and you guys had seeded wildflowers.
Yep.
Right?
That's, yeah.
So what happened, I guess, yeah, so what's the, so what happened next?
Well, you know, we got in touch with the staff. I mean, there were a couple of days there, the early on, the Monday and the Tuesday and into the Wednesday that, you know, I was still on campus on Tuesday, and the communication was difficult. You know, a lot of the cell towers were down. I had no internet. Sometime I would be able to use my cell phone and contact people. So I just, you know, we got together virtually as a staff. We planned a meeting for, I think it was that Thursday, that we would meet off campus. Obviously, the town was closed. We met in the boardroom of a local bank, and we talked. We first just checked in with each other to reassure each other that, in fact, we were all safe and our families were safe. And fortunately, no one on the Airmont staff lost their home or had any loss of life. We all knew people who had suffered the loss, but... So I think we took stock of that. I think we were grateful, and we started making decisions then about what we could do and how we could respond. And that's when I think you, not to harp on it, but I think that's when you go back to what your values are. You know, we're an artistic community. We're part of this community. We're more. We like to think that we're more than just a craft school. We feel like we're a part of this community. And so we looked for ways to respond that maybe were outside of our normal activities, but they were things we could do because of our facilities. And we're centrally located in town. So we made a decision to, we have a, the first thing is on December 10th, we have our annual holiday guitar concert. Bill Mize has been doing that for, I don't even know how many years, well over 20 years. And it's normally a fundraiser for us. Bill, I talked to Bill, and he said, we got to just help people. You know, we got to do something to pump people up and make people get in the spirit. So he performed for free, and he and his wife, and we had a reception. It was the first time I think many members of the community had gathered together, and to see people in the community hugging each other, telling each other, yeah, I lost my house, yeah, I lost my home, and hugging each other, crying. And it was a solidarity, that was a shaping, it was a healing, it was cathartic, and very real, very moving. Then a beautiful concert. Everybody ended, we ended the concert, everybody held hands and sang a cappella, sang Silent Night, and I don't think there were any dry eyes. It was very moving. So we did that, and then we looked at very practical things. We, for the next 2 weeks leading up to Christmas, we opened our dining hall to serve free lunches to anybody who wanted to come, whether they lost their homes, whether they were emergency responders, still working, utility crews. We had people come in every day, and that was put on by our staff. You know, we did that. You know, we put together, Jerry's Artorama helped us, and we put together 100 drawing and painting kits that we distributed to children who had lost their home or who were displaced, so they could begin that process of documenting and expressing themselves, maybe a little bit of jump start on the healing. We opened our studios up. to people who needed a place to work, who lost their studios. We contacted Surf Plus, a national organization, who gave us resources or connected the artists to resources, some grants, some loans, some things to help them navigate the services that were available to them. So we sprang into action as more of a cultural, you know, a community center. And it made us realize that, you know, our purpose is can be pretty large and our impact can be pretty large. I mean, I happen to believe that art impacts the culture, but this gave us a very tangible, practical way to prove our relevance and to reach out and help people. And so it was a... as horrible as it all was, it showed me another side of Aramont and our potential that I maybe had not really thought about.
Sure.
And of course, the silver lining, Chris, I mean, you look for something good, and silver lining is that thousands of people, I mean, the night of the fire, I know that the media had some media outlets had reported that the school had burned down, the school was destroyed, and of course, then I was posting on Facebook because I was here saying, wait a minute, it's not gone yet. And but that night, I was already receiving text messages, email messages when I finally got to be able to check my emails. I had a backlog of messages from people all over the country and all over the world saying, I'm concerned. I came to Aramont in 1968 and took a workshop, and my heart is with you. You know, my thoughts are with you. What can I do to help you?
Yeah.
So what you realized is kind of referring to what we were earlier. You realize that over this period of time, dating back to the first workshops in 1945, that this place has affected thousands, tens of thousands mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. people. And those people, when something tragic happens, when you think something's lost, and you don't take it for granted anymore. And
sure.
suddenly those people were saying, oh, my gosh. Some people said, I hadn't thought about Aramont in 30 years, but I just saw on the news, as you said, or I heard on the radio.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, oh, my gosh, you know, what can I do? I'm so concerned. So that was very uplifting and continues to be motivating. I mean, I think of not a day goes by, I don't think of that when I – If I become a little complacent or a little lost in my routine, I realize that, you know, I've gotten to be involved with something much bigger than myself, something that's truly extraordinary. And this brought that home.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, that's amazing. The literal rising from the ashes there. So what is so what's next for Aramont?
Well, fortunately, because we lost some dorms, but we didn't lose any of our studios or any of our main buildings, we didn't miss a beat. I mean, we had all of our workshops that we had scheduled for the spring and the summer. We're right in the middle of them now. Enrollment is up this year. We have more people than ever taking workshops, which is a miraculous and wonderful and empowering thing. We have... I just recently, the last couple of days, the board and our facilities committee and myself have reviewed and signed off on our plans, our architectural plans for a new dormitory. We're going to build a new dormitory right in the same spot where the old dormitory is. It will be a new and improved facility, 42 rooms, an elevator, and all rooms with private baths and a wonderful larger screened porch than we had before with a fireplace. And it's just going to be a spectacular building. And so as much as you hate the loss, the silver lining is we're able to update and build something even better than what we had.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I appreciate being able to come up today, and I appreciate your time and the stories about, you know, where you came from, what led Aramont to be what it is, and what, you know, what people have
sure.
to look forward to. So tell people, tell the folks out there, if they want to learn more, where do we go?
Well, the easiest thing, of course, we have a Facebook page, mm-hmm. and we love to have people follow us on Facebook. We're pretty active on that. We keep up with what's going here in the studios and what's going on with our activities. Aramont.org is our website. It gives people a complete listing of all our workshops, all our catalogs. We do have an Instagram account, just hashtag Aramont. That's a good way to keep up with things. I think if I wanted to tell people things, whether they're in this area, this region, Knoxville people, Sevier County people, or people from throughout the world, one of the things people have to understand, and I think we touched on it pretty thoroughly, it's not just, you don't have to be an artist to come here. You don't have to already, well, I can't go to Aramont. That's where artists go. You know, we're not a degree-granting school. We are an immersive workshop experience. And I still remember 32 years ago when I sat in the auditorium for the welcome, and I looked around me and I said, I bet everybody in this room is an artist but me. And what I realized, yes, there were some artists in that room. There were some very accomplished people in that room. And later I got to know them and I worked side by side with them and they encouraged me and they shared with me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had had an empowering creative experience. And that can happen for anybody that wants to come here. They need to understand that that's what we're offering. That's what Aramont offers. I'm not saying that everybody that comes here will be a stained glass designer. I don't think everybody will come here and end up being the director of Aramont after 30-something years.
Specific.
You know, but my point, Chris, the whole theme of what thinking back about what we've talked about, the theme is that I have always just pursued the next thing that I thought was compelling and interesting and would make me have a more meaningful and creative life.
Sure.
And this place has been a big part of that journey. And so, you know, it's my honor to have attached myself to something much bigger than myself. And I think our whole staff feels like that. We've got a tremendous staff. They work very hard. They understand the values. I keep coming back to that about what we think is important. And, you know, they live that out.
Well, that's awesome. People are born creative and curious.
I think so.
And a place like Aramont keeps that up. And it keeps – and one thing, I think if there's anything that, you know, that I'm going to kind of take away from this talk is our responsibility to create. Our responsibility to take those – our responsibility to contribute. So to everybody out there, thanks for your time. I'm really glad that you guys have been listening, responding, subscribing, and all that kind of stuff. Again, I am Chris McAdoo, and this has been Bill May, the Executive Director for Aramont School of Arts and Crafts. Learn more at aramont.org. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram. And we'll see you next time around. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed it.
BestBehavior.com